pie, key lime pie, raspberry pie. Banana cream pie. You guys got any other ones?
Coconut cream pie.
Yeah, coconut.
It is really enthralling and all, but I hate to interrupt. Welcome to Hate to Interrupt. I am Ethan from youtube.com/Gulif, and I am joined by
Nick from Stop Culture.
VHS guy, Nick.
Yeah, and so the reason I was just naming pies is because of the famous pie scene in the 2017 David Lowery film, A Ghost Story, that we're going to be talking about today. I know Nick has seen this film before. Have you seen it, Ethan?
No, I've never seen this. I've wanted to see it because I saw his, I think he made it right after this, was a Green Knight, and I have mixed feelings on that, and I've been curious about this one.
Yeah, I really like the Green Knight. He also did, it's kind of like a children's movie, Peach Dragon. Have you guys seen
that? Yeah, it's like a remake of a Disney movie.
He also did that really dog shit Pan and Wendy movie or whatever.
Peter Pan and Wendy? Oh yeah, I never saw that.
And he also, he worked on the new Star Wars Jude Law thing. You know what I'm talking about?
Like
the
called, skeleton yeah. crew?
Yeah, the yeah. skeleton key or something. And is it the skeleton crew or the skeleton key?
I think it's so. I didn't watch crew, it. Yeah. No one here watches Star Wars, and that's a good thing.
Okay. Well, yes.
You'd think from this movie he's like some like auteur-ass director, but he like kind of just works on mainstream shit a lot of the time.
I think those are both his like paycheck movies.
Yeah, he's both. So. I mean, The Green Knight is definitely an auteur movie, you know?
I saw that he took basically the majority of his funds he made from Pete's Dragon to make A Ghost Story because it's a very low budget, and he just basically went, okay, I'm going to self-fund this.
Yeah. So I'll give like a little plot synopsis of A Ghost Story. It stars Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara as like a young couple who lives seemingly out in the middle of nowhere in like a pretty objectively awful house, but Casey Affleck really likes it. They're having some issues in their relationship because Casey Affleck wants to move, or no, Casey Affleck wants to stay and Rooney Mara wants to move. Then he ends up getting, he has like a ghost based accident that happens to him that turns him into a ghost, and he has to walk around in like a children's Halloween ghost costume for the rest of the movie. And
just a straight up sheet.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically a movie about attachment throughout time. What might happen to us after we die. It's a movie about a lot of things, but
it's a big movie.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. It's a movie with a lot of big ideas that has a kind of small feel, small budget feel and small scope feel. What'd you guys think of it? Did you really like it?
Go ahead, Nick.
I like it. I really think the soundtrack fucking is really good, and it's pretty. It definitely feels a bit nihilistic for my taste. Like, I mean, if I had to like punch some holes in it, but
what's nihilistic? Because
I disagree. I don't think it's nihilistic at all.
It feels like a film very much about like the insignificance of human life and like how what we do doesn't really matter.
I think it's kind of like the exact opposite of that. I mean, I think the scene in the party, that's kind of like that hipster guy who is just like the most pretentious guy
in the entire world. The universe is going to explode.
But where does the movie like counteract any of the points the man made?
Well, the reason why it's ironic to me is because this guy is, you know, a human who doesn't know what happens to people after they die. He doesn't really know what he's talking about. This is what he thinks about the world. You know, he thinks that all of our endeavors are pointless. There's no point to being a creative person. There's barely, like he was saying, your kids are going to die. Your kids. Can you imagine, by the way, can you imagine fucking saying that to like a mother at a party?
I would punch that dude in the face. Like, what the hell's your problem, dude?
Yeah. Well, he's funny too.
Cause like he like looked completely out of place at the party too. Just
he looked like a 45-year-old
balding hillbilly that I don't know, it was a weird vibe.
No, I mean you would see a guy like that at a hipster party. I think he's an aging hipster who I actually found out that guy's a musician too. I was listening to
his music
after I figured it. He was great in the role.
I think he probably had the most lines out of anybody, and he's in one scene.
Yeah, no, but I mean, like, what he's saying all this stuff about how it's everything that we do is pointless because no matter what, the universe, the world is going to end. Nobody's going to remember the things you do. But it's not nihilistic in general, the movie, because everything that Casey Affleck's character is searching for is still these like little glimpses of meaning that he was able to hold on to in his life now that he's not even a part of it anymore. So like those things meant so much to him that he's still attached to this one space in time, even though he can go anywhere. He can go anytime, clearly, because he doesn't experience time in a linear way. He doesn't experience space in a linear way either. So it's just those connections that he made. I mean, here's the song he wrote. It's just everything that that guy said is refuted throughout everything Casey does throughout the movie. You know
how though? I mean, everybody did move on from him. Like he kind of became pointless.
Well, it's not.
His existence was pointless.
I don't think it's point. I mean, you know, we grieve for people. We remember that. You know, we remember the memories we had with them and everything. But you can't. You know, you have to move on with your own life. I mean, I'm talking about it more from his perspective. You know, for he wanted so bad to just like finally get that. Just he wanted to see the note, like whatever she left for him in the house. You know, that was the thing that he was holding on to. And when he could finally, you know, however long it actually took him to do that, because he went so far into the future and then was able to go back to the past and just live it all over again. And the second he finally gets the note, he's like, all right, now I feel like I can go.
He has closure.
Know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. True. That was the reason he hung around in the first place, because you get that whole moment where he wakes up in the hospital as the sheet man, and the doorway opens up to like the beyond, and he just goes, I'm gonna take a lift.
yeah,
I don't know.
So yeah, I mean,
I just really loved all that.
Yeah,
and I would say the note was handled well. Like I know I always say I don't like ambiguity, but like the note not showing what the note said was nice. I mean, I like the kind of idea of like wondering what she said to him.
I also love that effect of the sheets collapsing once the ghosts have closure. The other one was a bit more sad to me because it wasn't like I have closure. It was just like, oh, they're never going to come back for me.
Yeah.
And then they just fall into the sheet. That was really sad. And I was like, I don't even know anything about you. We just know you're waiting for someone that will never show up.
Yeah. I like how the ghosts communicate with each other. They're the only ones who can see each other. It's children.
They communicate with subtitles.
Yeah. The children see the ghosts and then the ghosts see each other. That's the only communication that they're ever able to get.
So really my most important question about this movie is like, do you think Casey Affleck was actually the one in the ghost suit?
He was, apparently. That's what they said. He was in the thing the entire time.
Yeah.
That's sick. Good on him.
No,
I mean, coked out Affleck.
I really do. I think it's a beautiful thing because I think a lot of people don't like that scene in the party. Because of the way it comes off aesthetically, just imagining yourself being at a party with a guy like that, which I think is something that, you know, a lot of people have experienced. But I think the movie goes to like great lengths to try to prove to the viewer that that guy is actually wrong. And it does matter what we do here, because even after we're gone, we're still obsessing over what those connections meant to us. You know, that to me is like what the movie is really trying to say, I think. You know what I mean?
Maybe so. I don't know. I mean, the first time I saw this, I saw it in theaters. That's the only time I've ever seen it. So it was kind of nice to revisit it. Because I think I really only appreciated it on like a visual and like audio level. I didn't really think about it too much when I first watched it.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that just the conceit of having the main character be, you know, dressed in a children's ghost costume with just like, you know, a sheet with eyes poked through it. It's just a really, really ingenious visual. I think it's like, you'll always remember seeing this movie. Yeah. Because of that, because it uses something that looks, it, you know, it looks like very childish, obviously, but the way the metaphor or the, you know, the visual cue is used to such great effect. Like, I think it's really brilliant decision.
Yeah. It turns what is like a very silly kind of iconic image to honestly a very sad image to me.
Yeah
I think the first half of this movie is much harder to get through than the second half. I think the second half is when it really starts to hit its stride and it's way more interesting and like the concepts it's exploring are so much bigger. But the one thing I do appreciate about the beginning, even though I wasn't as interested, was because it was so slow. Like, for example, like the 5-minute or whatever it was pie eating scene with Rooney Mara, it's like time is going so slow in the beginning, and then as like time progresses, it starts like picking up so rapidly for the character. By the time like he time travels back, we don't even get to see the whole thing. He's just back to the modern day when the note gets put in the wall.
Yeah.
Movie's like so simple, like as far as how it's like filmed.
It's quaint.
Like they don't show, I don't think they show any actual, I think the only action, like I say action, not like people fighting, but like action as in like things are happening.
You missed that fight
scene. Is the scene whenever he's like poltergeisting, like just, everything else, like like even the car crash scene, like it's just like slow pans to like to everything happening off screen. It was kind of like almost like a like reading like a kid's book, you know.
The poltergeist like scene was so fucking funny, because like you imagine that'd be terrifying in your like to that Hispanic family that he was tormenting. It's like horrifying because all the stuff is flying out the shelves, but the visual of a man in a big sheet just grabbing all of your plates and slamming them on the floor is so funny.
The part that got me is just milk glass floating to the
he's just like
And that was actually because at the party scene, like right after that, you hear at the, you know, in the before the dickhead hipster guy starts talking, you hear people are like, oh, you know, do you believe in the spiritual world? So it's assumed that like since that happened to that Hispanic family, like now this is like a famous haunted house. Yeah. Which was also kind of cool.
Imagine being at that party and a bunch of these people start surrounding around the like really old hipster douche when Kesha is literally at the party.
She was there.
She's one of the background actresses because they wanted, I saw this on the trivia. They wanted to use her music for the party. And when they asked, she was like, oh, can I come to the set? And they're like, sure. And then they just let her be one of the background. I think she's the girl who is like watching the card trick.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't even realize that. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't ultimately think it's like a sad movie or nihilistic or anything, but it would be, you know, imagine if this is what actually happens to us after we die. You know, like we have to walk the earth for fucking, or not even walk the earth, just stay in like just one house one that spot. We lived. Yeah. That'd only be able to talk to other ghosts, to frighten children, throw milk, throw plates. And then until we finally get like just one little note that probably had like six words written on it, then we get to move on, you know? That's the thing. Like he chose not to move on initially.
He was given the option.
And I think that, you know, I know you guys don't really believe in ghosts, but that's a common, you know, theme through people that study this stuff. It's like if there's a really traumatic death that happens instantaneously and you feel like you have unfinished business left on Earth, you end up like not wanting to move on to whatever is next after this like material plane. You want to stay there and try to figure out how you can get some kind of closure on it, you know.
But I feel like these types of, I mean, this is not about the movie, but I feel like these types of things are like, it's the same as like how vampires and shit are made up. It's like people have a concept. It's the same as like writing a script or writing a movie. Like people are like, this would be cool. And then they just keep talking about those things, you know?
I wouldn't be surprised if David Lowery believes in ghosts, though. I don't think you could write a movie like this and not believe in this like spiritual things, you know?
I don't know. I feel like this is something I could see myself writing, even though I'm not. You can ask anyone. I don't believe in ghosts, but I could write a. I think I would write. I would love to write a story about ghosts or something.
Yeah, because it's all about like there's just the symbolism, you know. Like the novel I'm writing is like about angels and heaven and shit, but I'm not necessarily religious in any way.
But this movie, it's you know, it's not just using like angels or you know heaven or those characters as like a backdrop for narrative. It's like he really is like trying to say something about what he thinks happens to people after we die, you know. Like I think this is probably what he really thinks about it, you know. You guys don't
so I have so. A quote from Lowery right here, actually, from Interview Magazine. He says, but I do believe in ghosts, even though I don't believe in an afterlife, and there's an inherent paradox there which I can only explain as the result of my faith in the mysteries of the universe.
Yeah, so that's strange to me. If you don't believe in an afterlife yet, right? Yet making this movie. I mean, you know, like you said, you don't have to believe in all the shit you're writing. Not like Ari Aster actually believes in all the terrible things that he writes in, you know. But I don't know. To me, it just felt so deeply personal to him. Like this kind of script, it feels
definitely
like,
felt like he was like trying to like make sense of something in his head while he was writing it, more so than it being directly tied to what he believes.
Yeah, you know? I don't know if it's entirely a belief story, more so like he used this concept as like a framing to discuss the ideas and themes of what it means to be human, how small you feel, and the concept of like legacy, what will mm-hmm. happen when you die, what is going to be talked about, remembered about you, or is it going to matter at all? I think those are much bigger ideas than just simply afterlife stuff. I think that's kind of what he was getting at, is at least what I took.
Yeah, because even Casey Affleck's character, like he was more focused on what was happening in the real world than anything that was happening to him, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think you're right about that, because it's definitely something that everyone goes through, but especially artists, I think about what their legacy will be. You know, like you want to leave things that last after you're gone and everything. And for him, I guess it's not trying to create a legacy made out of these like grand gestures and, you know, works of art that people will remember you by. It's more just like the small connections that you make with the people that are most important to you. I think that's like really what he's trying to say, I think. But I don't know, generally I really love this movie. You know, I really think this, it's a very beautiful movie. It definitely hits me in a sweet spot. You know,
I really like the decision to have it be, what is it, 4:3 aspect ratio, but also
it's
has
4:3
like
but they also like, yeah, they added
lines on it. I thought that was actually very nice, because it makes it still feel very like kind of like snapshot memories, you know, like you would see a lot of old photos in that same like framing. So to have it be like snapshot of someone's life and snapshot of like a lot of the movie feels like that, like he's just capturing images as time moves on. I don't know. I thought that was very, very sweet. And it was that contrast, because the movie has such big ideas, but it's also told in such a like one location, basically.
Yeah. The thing, the part that I could see people, like I showed this movie to my parents, I think, and I think they might have been with it up until he starts going into the non-linear time stuff, you know, like when he goes way into the future, jumps off the futuristic Blade Runner ass balcony, then ends up in the past with like a bunch of American colonists or whatever. Like, and then at the end, he starts seeing himself again. That's when I started being like, okay, what does this mean? Why is he seeing the other ghosts? Why is he seeing himself? You know, I don't know. How did you guys make sense of that? Like the closed loop part.
As like it's essentially like for him, he has to repeat the loop. And it's like to grow and essentially get that note and that closure, he has to, you know, die, live through this whole thing, watch his house get destroyed, go to the future, jump all the way back, do it again up to a certain point until he can get it again. And then once he gets it, that one's done. And then the other one kind of goes on. It's kind of like a time loop.
Yeah.
For me, it made me question, like the first time I watched it, whether it was actually him the whole time. But then I was like, no, it wouldn't make sense that he'd want the note if it wasn't him.
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely supposed to be him. And it's funny how angry he gets sometimes. Like he really gets mad at her for talking to another guy. He gets mad at just that family for even just trying to move into his place. But I don't know, like since he can't talk, he can't even emote facially. We don't know like what he's feeling actually. The only actions that the movie creates to let us know how he's feeling is him throwing shit or just like making lights flicker, you know. But
you have to think about the passage of time that he's going through as well. It's like anybody'd be fucking mad.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. But that's,
we don't even know if he's registering every bit of passage of time. He might just be like blinking and it's like, oh, it's been 4 months.
Or it could be the opposite. It could feel like fucking ages for him.
True.
Well, it seems like, you know, remember that one scene when it was actually really cool how that was edited too, when she's like coming out of the bathroom, leaving, you know, and he's just like watching that happen all over and over again.
I really love that effect. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's all happening like very quick to him. He doesn't even like really perceive what time is anymore. He's just like there, you know?
Yeah. And then like certain moments will like really draw his attention and he can kind of, everything slows down for a sec. Like the guy at the door, or putting the note in the wedge in the wall.
So you guys you guys don't believe in ghosts at all? You don't think that it's possible for there to be ghosts?
I wouldn't say it's not possible.
Yeah, no.
What So what do you make of all the stories of people like having stuff like this happen to them, though? Do you think they're all just lying?
No, I don't think they're lying. I think they believe it. I think it's a lot of ghost stories, for me, at least the ones I've heard. It's like people go to a spooky place that they've heard is haunted. And then, you know, when you're in that heightened sense of like fear and when everything's silent, you do hear a noise or you start seeing things in the dark. Your mind is good at filling in gaps and also like, I don't know, just trying to create an explanation for it. Maybe not so much a logical, just some form of explanation, which is sometimes just, I saw a ghost. I don't have anything against people that do believe in ghosts either. I think it's fun, but I just personally don't.
I think a lot of people see what they want to see. Like, I've seen things that were weird before. And if I was the type of person who did believe in ghosts, I could probably draw that conclusion that that's what it was. But
so like
instead, I'm logical.
I feel like if I went to one of the most haunted places in the world and I do not believe in ghosts, I can guarantee nothing would happen except for maybe a noise would happen. If it was like a dark, loud place, or a not loud place, like a silent, abandoned hotel or something, yeah, I'd probably hear something, but I wouldn't go ghost. I would go, this is a big old empty building.
Yeah, well, you say that, but there are tons of people that are initially skeptics throughout their whole lives and then have an experience happen to them that they're not expecting. They're not, like, a lot of this stuff doesn't happen when they're like going on a ghost tour, and it just happens in their house or somewhere where they're out during the day. You know, like, it can happen to anyone at any time, really. You know,
but you don't think that saying they didn't believe in ghosts before their story doesn't just make their story more believable?
Wait, say it again.
Like, if I tell you a story about a ghost, right, or that I saw something weird, and I'm like, I didn't even believe in ghosts, doesn't that just make me seem like I'm more of like a believable person?
Oh, it just makes you're saying it just like gives them credibility to say that they're a skeptic.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess so, but I don't know. It comes down to like, I think we talked about this on our Halloween special a while ago, but I. You know, of course, there are just people that make up stories because they want to be on a podcast or like have a story that goes viral on Reddit or something. But I don't think all of these people are lying. I don't think that's possible. And I've had experiences in my own life that I can't really explain. And I feel like there are definitely stories out there and testimonials from people that have been saying the same thing for years upon years at this time. And I don't know. I don't know like what you gain out of just lying about it. There's so many stories out there that I don't know how you can just say like everyone's just making up shit or just seeing things, you know.
I don't think it's there's nothing to gain out of it other than it's fun, you know. Like you love talking about ghosts and stuff, and I think that's exciting for a lot of people, and that's kind of like all it takes, really. And I'm not saying there's any ill intent. I don't think they're like big deceivers. I don't think they're idiots. I don't think there's anything wrong with people believing in ghosts. But it's just, yeah, it's just for me, there's always explanations for it.
It's also
you guys also don't like look into this stuff at all, really. So you're saying there's explanations
like
for it.
Spooky ghost stories.
You're saying like there's explanations for it, but you don't really know all the information.
When I was a kid, I was mega into alien shit. Like, I'd watch, like, I'd get rent every, like, Area 51, like, VHS I could watch and, like, documentaries and stuff like that. Not so much ghosts, but I was big into the alien shit. I thought it was so cool.
Do you not believe in aliens?
I don't believe that aliens have been on Earth, but I'm sure the aliens exist in some faraway
land. Because I definitely believe in aliens. I don't have, like, any idea generally if they've been here, but I wouldn't be shocked if they have been.
Yeah,
that's where I'm sitting with aliens. I think they're definitely real, but I don't know. I don't know for a fact if they've been here, and I don't know for a fact if they haven't.
Yeah, I don't know. I just brought that up because I think this movie it really does. It feels like one of the most realistic kind of ghost story movies where there's not, you know, the ghost in this movie isn't there to scare anyone. He's like trying to It's a movie basically from the villain of a typical horror movie's perspective, you know, which is pretty cool that you get to just see what it feels like to actually go through time as someone that's left their body and doesn't really understand what that means, you know. But to me, as someone who's really interested in the supernatural, I find that like a really cool device, you know.
Yeah, I think this movie does a good job of, like, whether or not you believe in it, you can get invested in the struggle and, like, isolation of the main character and just how it would feel to be trapped in this horrible, like, as soon as I read the premise, I was like, ah, this movie's gonna be a bit of a bummer, isn't it? And it is for a bit of it, but I really, really like the ending. I got teary-eyed as soon as he opened the note and just like the sheet falls down. I was like, oh, that's really powerful imagery right there.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I guess it's one of those things where, wait, I'm sorry, Nick, were you gonna say something? I feel like I interrupted you.
It's fine.
I also just totally forgot what I was gonna say. Sorry.
I have a question. If you guys were ghosts, like in this situation, what would be your go-to scare tactic?
I mean, I think you have to target children. Sorry to sound like a predator.
Cut, take that out of context.
Because children are always the ones that see ghosts. People are the least likely to believe them when there's like a sighting or something. And I don't know, just with all the supernatural stuff, like I guess the thinking is that, like, since children are closer to what came before, they're more likely to have a connection to what comes after, so they are able to see stuff like this. I don't know. I mean, see, you know, that supernatural event that happened in the house after that new family moves in, that was traumatic enough for them to leave the house, which is obviously what he wanted. He just wanted to have a house by himself so he could just scratch at the wall. You know,
like, that's a pretty sad thing. Yeah.
I definitely don't think I would haunt anybody, because, like, I feel like I'm like a very, it's very easy for me to feel like very lonely. So I would just be trying to like talk to people. I'd be like, can somebody be my homie, please? Because I'm going to go crazy otherwise.
So I feel like the long takes in this movie, what I was, you know, it can be testing when you're watching someone eat a pie. I timed it for literally, I think, like 4.5 minutes she's eating a pie, which is it's rough.
It feels longer. Through.
Yeah.
it definitely crazy. Makes the movie feel like there's not that much substance at times. Yeah. I mean, this movie could have been like 45 minutes long, if we're being real.
I don't know. I think it uses most of its time well. I think a lot of it comes down to just being, what did you call upstream color, Nick? You said like it's kind of mumblecore a little bit in the first part and very vibes based. But I don't know. I think it uses its time.
I think the entire intro up to the crash could have technically been cut. I think a lot of those scenes could have been cut down. I think this could have been a short film.
No, I mean, you need that. You need that first scene where she's like, I leave a note everywhere. You know, I moved a lot as a kid and I need, you know, she needed to give the audience that context about like why she puts the notes there, why that would be so important for him to like stick around for what seems to be literal centuries just to find this note in the wall, you know.
Could have thrown that in some flashbacks somewhere.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think the movie is good. I don't think they needed to make it a short film. I'm just saying, I think a lot of it was extended through these like long scenes that were somewhat unnecessary, but it was his vision, so I'm not gonna like shit on it.
No, I can absolutely see this working as like a really, really cool short film.
I think, well, I mean,
it works great as a feature length film.
It's patience testing, but I think that's, you know, that's why he's doing it that way, to try to like get you into the state of mind that this ghost would potentially be in, or just like only being able to observe, not being able to like interact with the world at all. You just have to like sit there, these long takes, not really know what's happening or have much context at all, which is how the main character, the ghost, is feeling. So, I mean, your mileage is going to vary on that depending on how much the concept intrigues you. And it definitely, I remember seeing in the theater, and, you know, anytime you see something in the theater, it's going to grab you more because you have nothing else to do besides just look at the screen. But, you know, when you're watching someone eat a pie at home for 4.5 minutes, you're going to be like, okay, what else is going on my phone? You know, like,
yeah. So I definitely wouldn't say the movie's perfect, but I think it's really good.
Yeah. And it definitely really did make me think a lot. And, I really,
it makes you think about big ideas. It's a thinker kind of movie. You finish it and you go, wow, you kind of think back to earlier scenes.
Yeah. So, what would you guys rate it?
I'm going to give this one a 8 out of 10. I really, really liked it. And I think I will watch this one again. I'd like to show people this movie.
Yeah.
I'm at an 8 as well.
Yeah, me too. 8 out of 10. Okay. Maybe 8. Maybe 8.5.
I thought we were going to pull a last episode where you were like, I really dislike this thing. And then you gave it the highest rating.
No, no. I really like it. Does anyone have any final thoughts on it before we move on?
No, it's worth checking out.
Yeah,
I hate to interrupt. Approved.
Yeah.
HGI approved.
Yeah, and I mean, I really also liked The Green Knight. Ethan, you said you didn't like that one as much.
I like a lot of it, but a lot of it, I just don't feel like there's a lot of rewatchability to it.
It's Did also you... kind of meandering a little
that's,
bit.
That's my main problem with that one, whereas I feel like the meandering works in this, in Ghost Story, but I don't think it works in a lot of The Green Knight, even though I understand that The Green Knight does have that kind of old-timey poem knight vibe and like structure, where it's just like side quest, doing after side quest after side quest on the progression to the main story. But a lot of it does feel meandering when you're actually sitting down and watching it. I saw that one in theaters.
Why is it okay for a ghost to meander and an Arthurian knight can't meander?
They don't got nothing better to do.
You guys are that's not fair. You got the Arthurian knight, he was on a quest. He was on a vision quest to go find the Green Knight. Well, also, but that character design was so cool of the Green Knight.
Oh,
the visuals of it are amazing.
And the voice was so good with that Ralph Ineson.
Yeah.
Sick.
The giant scene, dude, remember that?
Oh yeah.
I think it was cool. I don't think it was like necessarily amazing. And I love Dev Patel so much. So I was like going
Dev Patel to be in more stuff.
I was going in so excited.
Is it Hipster Lord of the Rings? That's whenever I think of that movie, I think of Hipster Lord of the Rings.
A little bit.
Maybe.
All right. So yeah, next topic I wanted to get your guys' opinions on is it's kind of a big one. It's like what do you think the role of critics in, you know, culture are? Since we are all effectively critics, you know, I guess, you know, amateur critics at this point. We make a little bit of money from doing it, I guess, but I'm bringing it up because I have conversations with friends a lot who are just like, I never trust what the critics have to say. Or if I bring up like, oh, I saw this review and I want to go see a movie because someone else said it's good, a lot of times you get like a backlash from that from certain movie fans. Like, I feel like a lot of people are like, I'm only going to go see it if it looks like something that's interesting to me. I'm not going to give a shit what anybody else has to say about it, whether there's somebody that gets paid to talk about movies or not. I don't know. I just like, what do you guys, how do you guys feel about critics in general?
I think they serve like, I don't know. It's they serve a very good purpose of finding people that you trust that have similar tastes to you. So that way you can have someone like, for example, I really like YMS or I Hate Everything, and they will, you know, talk about a movie that like they really liked, explain a little bit what they got out of it. And, you know, I might go, oh, you know, I like a lot of what I've heard them recommend, so I'm going to go check this out. And more likely than not, I will have a better experience with that. And I don't have to, you know, take a chance at just picking something on Netflix, which will probably end poorly. But I think the problem comes down to people's obsession with the number rating, specifically Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think it's not fair to ask me, because as somebody who kind of wants to talk about movies with like an unbiased kind of opinion that's all my own, I don't really watch critics anymore, because I don't want their views to kind of influence what I think about something. But historically in the past, I mean, I don't think the role of a critic has changed at all. Even since like the Ebert and Roper days, you know what I mean? It's like, I think it's all kind of, you just need to find people you agree with, right? I mean, I think there's a lot more critics nowadays. There's a lot of people that you're probably, you know, a lot more people are criticizing movies that you're probably going to disagree with. So, I mean, it's probably a little bit harder to find people that have the same opinions as you, because there's a lot more to kind of flip through and find out who's kind of a hack or not.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I still think the role is useful, especially for people whose lives aren't movies, right? I think the average person might need somebody to kind of point them in the right direction of some movies that they wouldn't normally find. I think there's a lot of YouTubers that are probably out there kind of like helping people find new movies.
Because like the general public, what are they seeing? Like maybe 3 movies a year. Because it's expensive if you want to go to the movies. And like general public, I'm pitching like a family of like 4 or 5, like a 2 adults and some kids. That's going to be like $100+ to go to the movie theater. So they're maybe doing that a handful of times per year.
People are still watching movies at home.
That's true. I'm leaving that out. I'm just talking about like the movie going experience at the very least. So like big budget stuff that's coming out is like those people, the general public, they do not listen or read reviews. They just go, all right, let's go see Red One. What's the Rotten Tomatoes score?
Yeah, they'll check the score.
They go off that. That's it. That's all they go, whoa, 78's pretty good.
I think Rotten Tomatoes is like probably the worst thing that has happened to film criticism. Just based on nobody, even to this day, which with how, like, nobody understanding how that system works.
The general public do not get it. They go, well, it's got a 90 whatever percent. It's like, if you give so let's say 100 people review this movie, everybody gives it a 6 out of 10. It will have a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. Because if you get a 6 or more, it is a positive rating. That's the problem.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that people just do a quick glance and you know, artists and auteurs that spend all years and millions of dollars potentially creating a singular piece of art, and then it all just gets reduced down to a single score out of 100 in the couple days after it's released. That's really unfortunate, and it definitely devalues their work and their art. The fact that a bad Rotten Tomato score can really kill a movie, sucks.
Absolutely.
I definitely feel bad about that.
I still check IMDb scores sometimes, like when I'm unsure about like if I'm like stuck between 2 movies to go see, and I'll check on IMDb because it's actually based on the scores people are giving. And more or less, do y'all ever compare like y'all's scores to movies to like online scoring systems ever? Just see like kind of.
I'll check Letterboxd, but like it doesn't really affect what I end up giving something.
Yeah,
I generally fall pretty close to where the average is for IMDb ratings. Like I've checked Metacritic, I've checked Letterboxd, I've checked all of them, and like as far as like where I sit on movies, it's pretty close to IMDb, closer than anything else.
Wait, so this is more of a Rotten Tomatoes question, though. Like, do you tend to feel yourself, if you're checking to see a Rotten Tomatoes score of a movie, do you gravitate more towards the audience score or the critic score to see how you might feel about it? Yeah, that's kind of my thing, too.
Just because, like, the audience score for, like, Deadpool and Wolverine is, like, 93%, and I'm like, okay.
I don't actually look at either of the ratings. I click audience score, and then I start reading some reviews until somebody says something that seems logical.
Which you might have to scroll for a while to get that.
It's going to take a while.
One of my favorite things that Red Letter Media does is when they pull out the, if they watch a movie like A Ghost Story, for instance, that's a little bit more challenging. They'll just be like, dumbest movie ever, ghost didn't this movie talk.
I literally pulled up a bunch of reviews on Rotten Tomatoes from audiences.
got any good ones?
It's exactly, let me find one. they're exactly what you'd expect.
Boring.
I tried to give it a fair chance, but it's really just not very good. It's slow and boring. No, actually very slow. Pointless film. Normally enjoy unique, different wide perspectives, but this didn't work.
I feel like when they say that, that's like just like automatically not true. They're just trying to it's the same thing as the ghost thing. They're just trying to give themselves a little bit of credibility.
Yeah.
I'm not really a ghost believer, but I watch all kinds of indie movies, but
oh, here's one.
That's
from
not
Ben.
What the ghost thing is, Nick. I swear
boring
to God.
Boring and very slow. If you like watching someone eat pie on the kitchen floor for 10 minutes, then this movie is for you. Not a ghost story at all.
It's not
it's
a
pretty
ghost
funny
story
though.
At all.
That's hilarious.
It's the most ghost story movie of all ghost stories, I
it's
think.
It's got the most ghost on screen at once.
It's literally the ghostiest movie I think you could ever
One thing
make.
that annoyed me, I wish they would have made the plates fly without showing him as the ghost every once in a while, like flip between them, so that I could have seen some plates so fly funny, on their own.
Just seeing Guy and Sheet throw plates.
It makes
it sad.
I was wishing that, you remember the scene when the kid is like, he looks back into the hallway and he sees Casey Affleck. Yeah, he sees him standing there. I thought it would have been cool to like shift back to his perspective and then to see Casey Affleck without the sheet on his head just for 1 second, like looking scary.
That would have been creepy.
That would have been a cool jump scare. I was like expecting to see it
half. The one jump scare was right at the end too. And it was like a fake out jump scare.
Yeah. Was it the bang on the window?
Yeah,
on the window. But yeah, one thing you said before, Nick, about not watching or listening to critics because you are one yourself. That's kind of interesting to me, though, because I feel like it would be like a songwriter be like, I'm not going to listen to music, you know, because I don't want anyone to influence my music making, you know. It's all about
there are musicians that do that, though. I mean, everybody kind of has like a different process with things. I don't think I'm missing out by not listening to reviews, and I will sometimes go and like listen to like what people have to say after I've already formed my own opinions, but I just will not do it until I've actually seen it.
That makes sense. Also, I think there's a difference between a straight up critic like someone like Chris Stuckman or Jeremy Johns.
Get Stuckmanized.
Yeah. Or someone that does video essays that we tend to do. Because I think the role of the critic is more about like trying to help people decide whether they should spend money on something, like what Ethan was talking about before, knowing that, you know, that's what critics started as. They're like, should you spend money? Should you spend time going to see this? Whereas like a video essayist or an analyst is more about, this is how you can contextualize this movie, or here's how you can think about it, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's helping you understand the movie instead of just saying whether it's worthwhile or not.
Yeah, I definitely
those videos
don't.
Videos are so popular that are like ending explained, and there's a big red circle and a big arrow pointing to the ghost sheet.
Do y'all see yourselves as critics? Because I've never pictured myself that way.
I mean, on the podcast, we are. We're critics, I think, on the podcast.
I guess so.
Because like, I think
say
that's
we're
what we
doing
do.
Right now.
But like, in this context, we're giving three different opinions. So it's not like people come in and they're getting like a set answer as to whether they like something or not. It's like they're getting three varying opinions on thing, and some people are going to dislike it, some people are going to like it. So it's more of a discussion than an actual like full-on criticism.
Well, Roger Ebert. What was the show he did with that other guy? They would constantly argue about movies, but those were considered reviews, even though they were. It was basically this format.
I mean, we do a rating at the end. That's kind of like that's a critic thing, you know, to let people that are listening know like what are that's us basically rating like how worthwhile the movie was. If it's worth people that are listening to us talk about it, we're trying to indicate to them whether it's worth their time or not to watch it.
And I also tend to unless I really egregiously hate something, I tend to not say you shouldn't watch something or something's not worth watching. I don't think I do that all too often. Because I think even like really dog shit movies, a lot of the time, like somebody's going to maybe get something out of it that I didn't. I don't know. Except for Ari Aster movies. I mean, anything else I think everybody should go check out. And fucking, what's the other guy I hate? I forget his name.
I don't know. You hate David Fincher.
No, I love David Fincher.
No, but yeah, I don't know.
Don't die.
I have friends. I feel like it's kind of like egotistic to be like there are people out there who are critics who are ultimately at the end of the day they've developed expertise in movie analysis and like watching more movies than anyone you've ever met probably. And telling you and comparing the movie they just watched with their wealth of knowledge about film history and filmmaking, and story narrative. So I don't know. I think that's a valuable skill set than to just be like, I don't care about any of that. I don't know. I don't really understand that point of view. You know what I mean? To just disregard the entire profession of criticism. I think it's very common for people to do nowadays, you know, like, oh, fuck the critics, you know, it's almost as common as fuck the haters.
Maybe people say that. It's like maybe like the same as like the all cops are bad type thing, right? But like just because there's a lot of like people who aren't necessarily qualified as critics doesn't mean all critics are bad, you know? It's there's definitely people out there that have a wealth of knowledge, like you said, that can you can get something out of regardless of whether you agree with them or not.
Yeah. So what's a movie that you guys really, really love that has like a terrible Rotten Tomatoes score?
I made a whole video about this. Ooh. Freddy Got Fingered.
Oh, that's like a great movie. That's just, I've never seen it, but I've heard that's a
The Cat in the Hat with Mike Myers.
I love the part where he's like, "That was terrifying. Make you proud. Make you proud, son.
Daddy, would you like some sausages? Daddy, would you like some sausage?"
That's a really funny movie.
I'm the backwards man, the backwards man, the backwards man, the backwards man. I can walk back as fast as you can. I can walk back as fast as you can.
Tom Green is a legend, dude. I watched his video the other day. That was crazy. It was like was talking about how Joe Rogan has like monopolized the podcast industry, and they showed a video of Joe Rogan going on Tom Green's podcast from back in like, I don't know, probably the late 2000s, because Tom Green was the first person to really do stuff like this. Like his public access show is kind of the progenitor of a lot of the podcasts that we see now. And Joe Rogan was on that podcast and being like, dude, this is like, you could watch the gears turning in his head being like, holy shit, like I should do something like
that. The podcast was a separate thing from the Tom Green show, because he was doing the Tom Green show and then he got cancer, had to stop, went away for a few years.
Say he got canceled.
No, he got cancer and then he stopped, and then he did his podcast, which was like basically the first podcast. He brought Joe Rogan on, and that was when that happened. So it was separate from the Tom Green show, but it was way, way before anybody else.
Oh, so that was a different thing. Okay, my bad. But yeah, really, it's really interesting because Joe Rogan looked young. It looked like, do you know exactly what time frame it was? The video didn't mention, but
it was like the early 2000s, I think.
Yeah, he had hair. He looked younger. It was pretty crazy. But anyway, to answer my own fucking question from a couple minutes ago, I think that you guys watch that movie Spaceman. I put it on like my best list of 2024.
Adam Sandler, yeah.
Yeah, that movie got like a 54% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I was like, whoa, I love that movie. I thought it was so good.
Oh, interesting. Oh, I do remember hearing about this.
I think comedies a lot of the time are more prone to that happening. Because I made my video about movies that audiences hated that I really like. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were comedies, like the Dumb and Dumberer movie. Do y'all remember that? The second Dumb and Dumber movie?
No. Yeah.
That movie was really funny, but it just didn't have Jim Carrey and fucking, what's his name?
Guy's name?
The other guy.
I know exactly who you're talking about. He was
It didn't have them returning, so people just shit on it. But it was actually solid and had the same writing team and directing team.
Yeah, I watched that movie all the time when I was a kid. All of the classic Judd Apatow movies from the 2000s have terrible Rotten Tomatoes scores, like Anchorman and shit, which is just surprising to me because it's like, as a critic, you know you're going in to see like a dumb, a lot of times like gross out comedy. Why are you expecting it to be something that it's not, you know?
But I feel like those people are like, especially back in the back then, people saw it as like almost like a scratch to their reputation if they like something that audiences will hate. So it's almost like a fear of giving something a good score if everybody else hates it, you know, or if the audience comes and hates it.
What are you saying? Critics didn't want to be seen giving like lowbrow comedy movies a high score, basically.
That has to be what it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. But I mean, at the same time, like, I feel like if you're going to watch a movie like Anchorman, probably seeing the trailer, you got to know that you're going into it expecting like a really stupid movie that's just trying to make people laugh, you know? And it succeeds, in that.
No, it does 100%. But you have to understand they are seeing it before general audiences are seeing it, and they're scared that general audiences are going to hate it.
Oh, okay. So yeah, so they don't have context. Yeah, I guess so. But a lot of times, Rotten Tomatoes will upload reviews that, you know, happened back in the day. Like they'll go back and add reviews for classic movies that were literally published in like the 70s or something. Like I was reading an article about that. Like sometimes they'll just add new reviews to like recontextualize older movies. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, I've seen that. Like they like links from like the New York Sun from 1983.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly.
I was trying to go through stuff that like I really liked that generally is not well received. I really like Skinamarink, but like that's got like a 2.9 average on Letterboxd, so it's pretty middling on reviews. But I know that's just a weird movie. But
you talk about patience testing. That movie I know, is that ridiculously patience testing.
That's a movie that I definitely think shouldn't have been a feature film.
It was a. I mean, have you guys seen Kyle Edward Wall's YouTube channel? It's just that, but in short form. It's like 20 minutes.
I really thought that movie was shot on film. Goes to show how much I know. But
it,
like
how much post-processing they did to make it look.
Yeah. It really, it looked authentic to me. It looked like it was shot on like literally a potato camera from 1968 or whatever, you know?
All right, yeah. Here's my list. It was The Cat in the Hat with Mike Myers, Dumb and Dumber, Ghost Rider 2, Super Mario Bros., the original, Freddy Got Fingered. So those are the ones that I fuck with hard.
I think Ghost Rider 2 is fun. Like, there's some fun bits in it.
It's fun. It's that, silly.
Is that Nicolas Cage still?
Yeah, that's Nick Cage. He did mocap but they changed... for Ghost Rider.
They changed director. They brought in Brian Taylor, who did Crank. Yeah. But the problem with the movie was like, it was obviously written and intended to be like an R-rated action movie, but everything got basically toned down. So it's just, it's neutered. Yeah,
it's got fun action. There's a part where he pisses a flamethrower.
Well, apparently Ghost Rider is, they've been talking about bringing him into the MCU for a long time now.
They haven't. They did it. Do you guys remember that?
I think
show,
they already cast him.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah,
he was in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is still canon, I think.
Nick Cage.
I think I. No. I think they cast a new Ghost Rider, didn't they? Like a year
No, I don't
ago.
Think so. Well, where would they? Where would that character show up?
I don't know.
In hell.
Oh, in hell.
So what? Yeah. What's the lore behind Ghost Rider? Why is he a flamey boy?
I don't know anything about him. There's a few versions. I mean, I think the one from the Nick Cage movie, that's Johnny Blaze, and then there's like another version of the character that's
in the comics, Robbie I'm pretty Reyes? Sure he sold his soul. Like he sold his soul.
Yeah, he did.
To Mephisto.
But it was Mephisto. He sold his soul to Mephisto. Yeah.
So Mephisto is basically the Marvel devil, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. But then
It's the you guys know Tommy from The Last of Us, the actor.
Isn't he the he's the voice actor for Joel in the game, right?
No, he's the no, not him. The guy that plays Joel in the actual like HBO show, he plays the Ghost Rider in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or whatever.
Oh, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was ass. Well, I only watched a little bit of it.
They resurrected the main S.H.I.E.L.D. agent from the MCU.
Yeah, he was like a robot or something. They literally did the thing from Invincible.
They did Donald. I was about to say. They pulled the Donald on his ass.
Did y'all watch any of those like CW Marvel shows?
I never did, no.
I think I tried The Flash. Me and my sister were watching it. And we were both like, this is just a soap opera with a superhero skin on it. And it's it was funny. Like super melodramatic.
I was watching in... an interview with what's the name main actor's name
from Clark Gregg's,
the guy who plays Flash,
Grant Gustin.
He's like, it was an interview like a couple weeks ago, and he was like, yeah, it's hard whenever you're playing a character who's like this one of the smartest guys in the world and the fastest guy in the world, so like theoretically every episode should be solved in like 2 minutes.
Yeah. I saw I think it was like a little short video someone made, and it was like every episode of The Flash, and it was like, I'm Barry Allen and I'm the fastest man alive, and someone shows up like, actually I'm the fastest man alive and I'm evil. Oh man.
The Flash was genuinely, well, I think the first season was okay, but after that it was genuinely like some of the worst shit I've ever seen in my life. Same with Arrow. I watched Arrow up to season 4, I think, and then I was just like, what the fuck is this?
I know a little bit about the comic screen Arrow, and they just turned him into Batman. They just made him like,
he's basically
I'm the Arrow, and you like know, they I don't know, they just made him not fun.
So he's not the Green Arrow in the show.
He is Green Arrow, but he just is more gritty and like dark, and they make him cool. And then in like the comic, he's basically like, he's Robin Hood. He, you know, steals from the rich. He shoots people with like punching bag arrows or punching glove arrows. Like it's a little silly. And
yeah, he's a socialist.
Yeah.
The only of those, like, and it's not even really Marvel, but like the only of those like bullshit TV comic series I really liked was Gotham. Gotham was pretty good. But
I liked Gotham.
Yeah, actually,
I only watched the first season because it was just that the problem with that show for me was every character would show up and it would be like, hey, it's Harvey Dent. And as soon as you see him, he's like flipping a coin like, hey, what's up, guys? Mm-hmm. And then everyone's just like doing their thing immediately.
The biggest problem with that show was like everybody came back to life. Like there was nothing mattered. It's like, this guy died. It's the finale. Next season, they're like, oh, yeah, they're back.
Wasn't there like three Jokers?
Okay.
They used the Lazarus pit or something?
Yeah, and then like the guy who plays Joker, they didn't bring him back. It was actually his brother. So it's basically soap opera shit.
So his twin brother. The Joker.
Nobody's
the Joker. Nobody's the Joker.
The Joker's a concept.
They can't use that.
Yeah.
The Joker's a mind virus.
Speaking of all this kind of like CW schlock shit, I have a question. What are some of your guys's, they don't have to be good, what are some of your guys's like comfort shows that you will like turn on like going to bed that you can just like watch whenever and just like cozy? Because I have like, obviously The Office is one I would always watch going to bed. I like have that show pretty much memorized, but one that's not as good for most of the part is Supernatural. I watched a lot, especially as a kid. I would always watch the earlier seasons when it was very Monster of the Week, and I don't know. I just really like that format.
Even though every episode's the same. I met Jared Padalecki recently.
Yeah,
I told you all that.
Wait, so isn't
he's really tall?
The showrunner of The Boys is the same one as Supernatural?
Yeah, Supernatural. Supernatural is solid. I mean, it's stupid, but
my sister is a big Supernatural fan. She's seen all of it, and she said she hates it. But she said just watch the first five seasons because that's all Eric Kripke wanted to tell. And then they were like, "Well, the show's the biggest show ever. We're gonna keep it running to like 12
seasons.
Watch
it all. It turns into complete and utter dog shit. Just be ready for it."
Okay. Oh, we'll see. I'm on four right now.
I would just say watch it all, but it's bad.
A comfort show for me would be, me and my girlfriend watch Girls, and like she introduced me to Friends when we go to sleep. I was always more of a Seinfeld guy over Friends, but Friends is actually pretty good too. I don't know if you guys ever watched that.
Friends was always Friends on multiple at my times. Because I'm the youngest of seven siblings, so like the middle and older ones would always watch Friends.
Well, I feel like it's growing up for me, it was like you could either like Friends or Seinfeld. You couldn't like both, you know.
That's kind of true.
Because like
Friends, I was more of a Friends guy, growing up, but I like Seinfeld more now.
Yeah, well, I think Seinfeld is ultimately like the best, probably the best sitcom ever made, or at least like the most influential. I think so.
It's Always Sunny's better, and I would say Curb Your Enthusiasm's better.
Well, maybe the best multicam.
The best, yeah. Like traditional.
I mean, sitcom. Cheers is great though too. You ever sat and watched Cheers?
I never got into Cheers. Sounds
so old.
It's not even. But it doesn't feel old. Taxi's good. There's a bunch of old sitcoms that are good, but mine is Psych. Psych is, in my opinion, the best TV show ever made.
I think my parents own a bunch of DVDs that they gave me of Psych season one.
It's amazing.
Or something.
And then also probably Curb Your Enthusiasm. Psych and Curb.
Lately, Invincible's been, because I've been just like putting on Invincible in the background while I've been editing.
Comfort show?
I've been editing this video. And I'll just put Invincible on like low volume while I'm working on it. And I don't know. We never talked about the finale. What did you guys think of the Invincible finale?
That was awesome. I just like to imagine Nick sitting there cozily editing. Well, in the background, you hear, well, Debbie's more of a pet to me.
I thought the final episode was good.
I thought it was awesome.
You don't sound too enthused.
I really liked the voice acting. I was with you, Nick. I was like, that's not what I was imagining. but he killed it. I think Jeffrey Dean Morgan killed it.
I agree. I thought it was great.
I think they should have saved him. I think his voice sucked for the part, but
you guys think he should have been Thrag?
I don't know.
Thrag's like the main villain, right?
Yeah, Thrag is a main villain. I don't know.
I think he'd be a better Thrag than Conquest.
I think he was kind of awesome, and I heard that the two scenes that were not in the comic were like the blood bubble heart scene emoji, and then the little confession of his like deepest insecurities.
Yeah.
And I thought those two scenes were so awesome, especially the like confession. So much about this character. That's cool.
That's what made his voice not work for me, is because Jeffrey Dean Morgan always plays like kind of a pompous, like cocky asshole. And like, I didn't hear a hint of sadness to him, right? He doesn't play those characters really well.
You don't think the confession was sad when he's like, I don't even get a name, only a purpose.
I think the script was sad. I think I'll listen to it again. I didn't think his delivery was all that good on it, but.
And the parts where he's talking about like when he sees Mark caring for Eve, he's like, I'm starting to understand why your affinity for these lowly creatures or whatever, you know, like, I think there was some dimension to his performance. It wasn't one note. I don't think.
Yeah. Or just the bit where he's just like,
it wasn't one note. It's just
cry. I'm so sad, but no one would care.
But it's a tone thing for me more so than like
just the actual sound of his voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that. It would have been nice to have like someone with a little bit of a deeper voice doing it.
Yeah, just someone with like gruffer and feels like more lived, because he's old technically, but he has a very youthful energy to him.
You guys have you guys have read both or the rest of Invincible. Is Conquest like, where does he rank on like the strongest characters in the show? Is he like really up there?
I would say he's top five. For sure.
He's up there with like Thrag and like, is Omni-Man even in top five, or is he like top 20 or something?
It's hard to say, like, ultimately.
It's kind of a weird varying scale because it doesn't necessarily actually all make sense later with how strong Mark gets. It kind of makes everything kind of confusing.
Well,
there's a little bit of DBZ scaling there.
It's hard to get into that without spoiling it. But I mean, you probably know what happens kind of, right, Ethan?
I don't know the finale. I don't know anything.
Eve is probably top five.
Yeah. I mean, her powers alone, as soon as they introduced that like blocking mechanism where she can't control sentient matter, I was like, well, as soon as they get rid of that shit, everyone's fucked.
Yeah, but they can't. It has to,
has to be trauma unlocked.
Yeah. So it's not something she can tap into whenever. So which I feel like wouldn't even, that makes her not even top 10, you know. When she gets to that place, she's probably the number one. But
when she
other
goes
than
like
that,
Super Saiyan or whatever.
Yeah. Pinky Saiyan.
The one character I'm curious about, the only spoiler I know, so I guess spoiler for Invincible, is that like the one character has like zero depth, but I think is so awesome, and I love seeing him show up as Battle Beast, and I've seen how he gets taken down, and it's so fucking cool. Just and like what that, I already said spoilers, but like Thrag ends up wearing him as like a cloak.
Mm-hmm.
That's so metal, dude.
Yeah.
I love his like journey, how he's just on a quest to just find somebody who can fuck him up.
Yeah, I looked it up and I was like, why the fuck is this random lion dude just like beating the shit out of Viltrumites? And like nobody questions it. They're just like, yeah, that guy sucks.
Well, it's kind of...
I looked it up. He's like got an ancient curse. He's from like a planet and like he's cursed to find someone worthy of a battle to kill him in battle, and he gets like all these crazy strengths and stuff. That's like it.
Yeah, well, he's kind of like, he has an Alan the alien situation where the other beings of his race aren't as strong as him, you know, like I think the Battle Beast race are probably way stronger than humans because they're like fucking giant cat people, but like he can stand up against Viltrumites, which is not common amongst his people, and the Unopans of Alan's people, you can't really do that either.
Yeah, he got the shit rocked out of him and yeah. Season two.
But the fight between Thrag and Battle Beast is so cool though, because do you remember in the second season when Mark is talking about those dinosaurs that can kill Viltrumites, like the books that his father wrote?
Yeah,
it's like, read my books, Mark. Like that
read
part.
Read my books, Mark.
Yeah. So on that, when right before Battle Beast and Thrag fight, Thrag gets injured by one of those dinosaurs or whatever, and before Battle Beast starts fighting him, he's like, well, we have to level the playing field. So he like cuts his leg open because he wants like a totally fair fight. He is such a cool character. I agree.
I love, it's become a bit of a trope, but I love the trope of dude warrior character who just wants to have the most badass fight of all time and like wants it to be a worthy battle, like Thor in the God of War games or whatever.
Yeah. I've never played. Have you guys both played the God of War games?
I played the
not
new
the
ones.
New ones.
I've only played the old new ones.
I watched a cutscene. I'm like the king of just watching cutscenes and not ever playing a game. But I watched a cutscene when Odin and Thor show up at Atreus and Kratos's house, and they're just like having a nice little talk at first, and then it just all goes wrong, and they start beating the shit out of each other.
The shit out of them. Yeah, that's a fun game.
Also, Jormungandr is just one of the coolest characters I think I've ever seen. Just the giant
big snake.
Yeah. big snake.
What are some of your guys' like favorite mythologies?
Invincible.
when are we getting the next God of War game where he fights Jesus Christ?
Let me see. I know. I mean, Greek mythology is probably Greek and Roman. They're both very close, so I'd probably go with Greek.
Do you have
Greek,
a preference
though.
Of Greek or Roman?
Is I think Greek just is OG. Yeah, but
yeah.
Give me some examples of mythologies. I think they're all kind of lame.
Egyptian mythology, Norse mythology, Mesoamerican mythology. Yeah.
Like Norse
mythology, Roman mythology.
You know about like Coxicodal?
That's Mesoamerican, right?
Yeah.
Egyptian shit's cool because I like the mummy. Does that count?
That's apparently what the next God of War is going to be, is the Egyptian setting.
What about,
that's,
is there
that's
like,
cool.
Is there boomer mythology? Like, do you think they have their own their own mythology where like Bob Dylan is
they worship the nuclear the nuclear family.
Just Elvis Presley.
Yeah. No, yeah. So, the finale of Invincible I thought was really, really great. I'm very, very excited to see where they take it next. I mean, obviously, I know what the story is going, but
do you think they're going to be able to maintain the one season per year?
I feel like they probably will. I think they're maybe, it seems like they're kind of in a groove now, with getting stuff to the level they need to get it at. Maybe they did they expand the team or something? The animation team? Did that happen?
I don't know. I don't think
the
so.
The seasons aren't very long, so I mean that works in their favor too.
Yeah,
I saw that brought up a couple points because everyone's been talking about animation quality and how for some episodes it's JPEGs floating on the screen, and then you get to the finale where they're like, I'm going to draw every single strand of Mark's hair when he gets the shit kicked out of him. Mm-hmm. I saw it was the YouTuber Cosmonaut Variety Hour was talking about it, and he's like, you know, people complain about the celebrity voice casting and how they're spending all that money when it could be going to the animation. But the reality is, if they weren't getting celebrity voice casts, that money would not be going to the animators. They would. The reality is, we either get what we have now, one season per year, or we get every season every 2.5 years, and it looks slightly better.
Yeah,
I'm gonna be honest. The first season looked by far the best.
I think so too. I actually watched a few clips from season one. I was like, this looks better than I remember it looking.
Yeah,
the fight where Omni-Man's like fucking up the Justice, whatever the fuck,
the Guardians of the Globe,
and then the scene where he's fighting Mark, like both of those scenes were better than anything we've had in previous seasons.
The coolest thing in the show is when Omni-Man gets hit by a nuke. Remember that? Like it's right before
he
starts going
orbital laser.
Yeah, orbital laser or whatever. And it's just you just see a bunch of bunnies get murked.
And like birds fall out of the sky.
Yeah. That was a really great scene.
Yeah, so those final two episodes are so hype.
Yeah.
Is the next season of The Boys the last one?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, Eric Kripke, same guy, same Supernatural thing. So he planned out 5 seasons.
And that's not coming out until 2026.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to watch it. I didn't even finish the last season.
You're going to watch it.
The last two episodes of The Boys season 4 were actually good. I didn't like the season overall. But the final two episodes were pretty all right.
I watched the first two episodes and I was like, I'm good.
How do you guys, like, it's kind of interesting to compare Invincible and The Boys, you know, because you know, they're both Prime shows, but they also kind of take that like cynical view of superhero media. But I think at the same time, like Invincible does it while still having a love for the, you know, the history of superhero comics and storytelling, whereas The Boys just like genuinely hates it and thinks it sucks, you know, which is why I think the show doesn't work as well.
Garth Ennis hates superheroes.
Garth Ennis.
Yeah. He apparently hates superheroes.
But you can't even compare because one's a direct adaptation and one isn't.
Can we address the way you say that word?
Adaptation, whatever, dude. We've looked it up and it both are acceptable.
I know. It just always throws me whenever you say it.
It's shorter.
It saves time.
Why say more word when less word work good?
See world. The thing I like about Invincible is it maybe at times can feel a little nihilistic. I've heard a lot of people say it's the white people's Dragon Ball. It's your very traditional superhero universe, but the nice thing is that the fact that this is all original and one universe and it all ends eventually, it has a definitive ending, means you can introduce really cool characters and kill them. They're not stuck in the same bubble that Marvel and DC are, where they have to resurrect characters constantly and keep reinventing characters and keep going like, well, Batman's still 30, yeah, even though he's 140 or whatever.
The difference between Invincible and like traditional like comic book comics is the writer isn't a comic book writer. Like he writes graphic novels. Like he did The Walking Dead. He did a bunch of series that aren't superhero based stories. He's used to telling actual stories. So it's like if Quentin Tarantino went to go write a fucking superhero movie, right? He's not going to make something like Marvel would make, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think ultimately one of the coolest things about Invincible is the fact that, like you said, Ethan, like it's able to change because it has an ending. Like they're able to actually change the status quo of the world, which clear, like in the real world, if superpowered beings actually existed, like we would have a radically different world. There wouldn't just be like, I don't even think there would be like a president or the same structure of government that we have in this world. Like, I think that allowing the world to actually change, given the gravity of all the power sets that so many of the citizens have, like that's just a, you know, it's a natural flow of how things would change in a world like that, which is why a lot of these other comic book series that have to go on for fucking decades and decades, they're never allowed to actually change the world, you know?
Well, that's why some of the best comic book movies are ones where they have a finite end. Like if you look at like Logan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Logan's like a genuinely super good movie, and that was because it was the end of Logan. They could make a story that was like finite.
Yeah.
But and I mean, you I see him show up again in like 4 years in Deadpool and Wolverine.
I disagree though, Nick. I think you totally can compare Invincible and The Boys. I mean, I think if you're going to compare any superhero media to one another, they're very similar in a lot of ways, you know? Like they're both critiques on the entire mythos of superhero storytelling.
Do you really think Invincible is a critique though? I don't think it's a critique on the superhero genre.
I think it critiques it while it also celebrates it, I think. Because I mean, you know, it's the evil Superman trope. They both use the evil Superman trope, where it's like if there was a fucking giant alien guy who is the strongest person on Earth, you might want to take it over. You know, that's in and of itself is a critique, I think.
But I think it doesn't function as like a parody though. Like it does poke fun at times, but in the end, it does function as a traditional superhero story with villains that work in the exact same way. Yes, everything is a little bit more like a final, like there actually has stakes, but I would say that just makes it a better superhero story. I would say it's an improvement on the genre more so than a critique of the genre.
Well, there are aspects of it that are a critique, I think. You know, it's not like it's not ultimately trying
it's
to be
a
parody
satirical
or
slant,
it's not a satire, I don't think, but it definitely has, you know, there are elements of it that are trying to critique larger superhero storytelling. Not as much as The Boys, but
I would look at The Boys almost as like a parody and like a very weird way.
Yeah, the Boys is very satirical, whereas Invincible, I feel like it subverts your expectations, you know, haha meme, for what you expect out of a superhero, you know, medium. Because like that first episode of the entire show, if you turn that on, most people would be like, oh yeah, it's just kind of like any other DC animated, you know, thing. Oh, they have their knockoff Justice League. And it's not until you get to the final section where you're like, oh shit, that guy got his head squished.
So you haven't read the comics of The Boys, right, Ethan?
No.
So Nick, I know Nick has. So like, Nick, I know in the show, that's the only context I really have. Like the show, it seems like it's mostly a critique of like corporatism and capitalism and everything. And like the boy, you know, the superheroes in The Boys are all, they're like a paramilitary organization that's owned by some huge like Disney or Amazon like corporation. Is that kind of like the main comment in the comics too, or?
Somewhat. It's more of like a critique on like Bush era, like America and like,
which makes sense since that's when it came
out. Yeah. I would say a lot of the elements of it are similar in terms of like what it's trying to say, but it definitely doesn't focus as hard as like on like parodying. Like, I mean, everything's changed since those comics came out. Like they didn't have the Marvel movies, and now everything is kind of has to be like these big franchises. And it feels like it pokes a lot. The show pokes a lot of fun at that.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like back then, it was like the big person that they kind of went to for information was this like comic book writer or comic book artist, and he would basically give all this weird insider information. So they're kind of focused more on like the comic book aspect and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that the one thing that really pisses me off is the, I think it's Eric Kripke, said like for The Boys, he's like, I just want to make sure I don't want to be a sellout, you know, with this franchise. And I'm like, you've already made a spinoff and you're making a show for like Amazon. What do you mean, dude?
Also, sellout is just such an outdated term now, I think. Like, you can tell that guy's Gen X by just saying the word sellout.
Oh, yeah.
That's like the worst thing that you could call someone who was born in the Gen X generation is a sellout.
It's a sellout. Yeah.
It's like, you're not being authentic, bro. But, yeah, I don't know. Nick, I watch, because I've been watching The Boys a little bit too, and just in the background of stuff while I'm working. And I watched your video about The Boys. And I don't have context for the comic, so I can't say a lot of things. But like, I literally just don't understand how you think Huey in the show is an asshole. He's not an asshole.
Really?
How is he an asshole?
He isn't. It's not so much that he's like directly an asshole. It's that like he is no longer the heart of the show. Like in the comics, he's like genuinely like pure of heart. He doesn't have like the same kind of like temptations that everybody else has. He doesn't have like these motivations to utilize his powers to like make up for how weak he is. Like in the comics, he's like completely okay with how weak he is as a person. Like he's very true to himself.
So would you say he's like Superman without powers?
I mean, he has like his own like flaws, but like
person. Okay.
Yeah, he's a very good-willed, kind person, and he doesn't mean any harm. And like that's like one of the first things that happened in the comics is they like basically unknowingly inject him with Compound V, and he like accidentally kills somebody, and like it's like this big horrible like moral dilemma for him. And it's just like it's him trying to function in this group of people with like zero like
ethics,
like morals, right?
Yeah,
like they don't give a fuck, and he's like the person who grounds everybody.
That's what he does now too. He still acts.
But he is just. But in the show, he's just as tempted as Butcher in a lot of these moments, and he's just as bad as Butcher in a lot of the moments. And that's not the case in the comics. And there's nobody who the person they kind of basically pushed his role off to Frenchie as like the grounded like person who actually cares about people. But I don't think it works as well.
I think it's they both have their own different distinct ways of caring for people. Frenchie's still a bit of an asshole.
I mean, Huey is the one who tries to get, instead of killing Victoria Newman in the season finale of the fourth season, he's like, no, actually, what if we stop trying to act? We're trying to fight monsters, something like that. Like, what if we do that by what if we fight monsters by acting human? Like, that's Huey's thing. And in the third season, when he starts taking the temp fee, that's a whole. I felt like that was a whole like toxic masculinity thing where he couldn't accept that his girlfriend or fiance or whatever is considerably more powerful than him. So he's like, I want to be able to be the one that protects you for once. So I don't think that was him being an asshole. He was just first of all, it was something that they had to try to keep up with them. Yeah. And it was an insecurity thing.
I mean, I'm not going to say that the way they're going is bad innately. I just personally don't like it, especially knowing the ending of the comic and like how the way his character acts impacts the ending and makes it make sense. Because do y'all know the ending of the comic?
I know the thing about Black Noir. That's yeah, basically
all. I know that. I know that about Butcher, what he does.
Yeah. So like, and the only reason like any of that ending works is because Butcher loves Huey so much. And I don't see that same kind of camaraderie between Huey and Butcher in the show.
I mean, I totally disagree. Like Huey, yeah. Huey is his Lenny. That's like, you know, that's a huge thing in the show. They always the come back to focus. That. Yeah, he's like, let me pull you it's back. Like he's from his the little brink. Brother. Yeah.
I don't know. I'll watch the newest season. Maybe my mind will be changed, but I just haven't gotten it.
I think that they left. I agree with what you said before, Ethan, about how I didn't really like season four, but the place that they ended it in, I think, is really cool. It's cool like,
oh, this
setup.
Is a great way to get us into the next season. It's super, it's a good hook for the second season.
Yeah, it feels like Endgame material, not the Avengers yeah. show.
It feels like also, a final season.
Like, why did they do this shit with Frenchie at the beginning of the season? Like, that made me not watch
yeah.
it.
Yeah, no, I will tell you, it's a waste of time. It really feels like a waste. It feels like they did not know. They were like, shit, we got to give Frenchie a plot line because we have no idea. Give him the whole trope of he's falling in love with someone, but he actually killed their family and it's a big secret. Oh no. And then that, you know, that whole thing gets revealed and it's like, I'm such a bad person. And then he locks himself in jail for like two episodes and then he gets out and the plot continues. That's yeah. literally all
so,
that does.
Like, it's so a waste stupid. Of time. Like I was like, why am I like, why I could watch nothing and have more fun than watching this. That was literally the thought that went into my head. And I went and sat on my computer and watched YouTube videos.
I thought you just like stood into the, you just stared into the wall for a second.
You stood in the wall.
You're just like, this is, I'm having fun more than like goddamn
so
boys.
Yeah.
Yeah. That whole relationship with Frenchie and the kid, because it was like, wasn't it? He ended up randomly meeting the son of some judge or something that he had to kill when he was a bad guy working for the bad drug dealers or whatever. That was what it was, right? And then
I don't know.
It was stupid.
He couldn't accept it.
And it was then, super contrived. And
the thing that like killed that like officially killed the boys for me was watching the boys diabolical and watching their animated comic episode and it just being absolutely wonderful. And I just was just like, we're never getting this. And that makes me so sad.
Where it just looked like the actual comic, but just
no,
animated.
They adapt an episode or a portion of a comic of the comics.
Oh, okay.
It was so good. It was exactly what I hoped the boys would be, and I was just like, this is all I'll ever get.
Was it voiced by the series cast or different people?
Different people. Well, they got the same actor for Butcher, but they brought in Simon Pegg to do Huey.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah,
because he was the model, right, for the original
yep.
movie.
Yeah,
that's why they cast him as his dad. That's cool.
But yeah, back to Invincible for a second. My favorite part, even despite all the great shit that happens at the ending, is the whole breakdown, the communication breakdown / relationship breakdown between Cecil and Mark in the beginning. That was so well done, I thought. And ultimately, it was
super interesting.
Like Mark, I don't know. Why the fuck would you get mad at him for doing that stuff? He knows what they're up against. They're up against all this horrible shit that they have no hope to even stand against besides Mark. And he's just like, no, actually, you're wrong for creating this stuff just because these people were bad at one point. Like, I don't know. I just think it's fucking ridiculous.
But he's also like a teenager. Like, it's like,
yeah, that's what I'm getting. He's like 19 or whatever. And he's 19. He's literally never, he doesn't go to therapy and he really needs therapy and he has no outlets for his emotions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only outlet for his emotions is sitting on his little roof with Adam Eve
with
at the end.
Adam
of
Eve. Yeah. I saw someone was like, I would just, I was Mark, I would just kill myself.
I'm so happy the Amber shit's done, bro. That shit was so annoying. They drug it out so long.
Oh, dude, this is an interesting thing that when I was reading the comics, I finished the comics like 2 weeks ago, and nice. I found out that Mark doesn't find out that William's gay until like 75% way through the series.
Yeah, and, it's like in a the big comics. Reveal. I remember hearing that.
They're not really utilizing him though in the show. Like they don't really care about his character.
I saw that Robert Kirkman kind of is treating the show as like a revision, like a revisionist kind of a second pass on the story. He's like, okay, anything I didn't get a chance to do or want to tweak, I will tweak as we go across the story.
Yeah.
So he's doing that. Yeah.
No, I mean,
I've heard there's some like slurs in the older comics.
It totally makes sense why he would change that from Mark just knowing and accepting that William's gay right from the bat, rather than being this whole thing like, whoa, are you attracted to me actually? What? Like that was how it was in the yeah. comic. And oh, no. It was kind of funny
because that's annoying.
Mark, did y'all ever see
Mark was like, yeah. No, I mean, just because, you know, I'm not attracted to every woman that exists. So, I shouldn't be insecure about you being attracted to me. And then William's like, no, actually, I think you're extremely hot in the comic.
That's funny.
It was pretty funny.
Did y'all ever see The War at Home with Rami Malek, that sitcom?
Mm-mm.
I've never heard of that.
What's that asshole New Yorker actor that sucks? Whatever, it doesn't matter. But
a lot of info.
But it has it has Rami Malek, and he plays this gay dude in it, and the entire show
Freddie
he's
Mercury?
Like closeted. Yeah, he's just playing this like closeted gay guy, but he's like super, super gay. And it's really funny, like just watching Rami Malek play this character. So if anybody hasn't seen it, go check it out.
And it's called
The War at Home.
War of the Worlds.
Oh, and the war is him being gay, or it's different?
He's not even the main character. He's like a side. He's like the friend that always comes over.
Oh, okay.
Do you ever get thrown off by that when you guys see like super big actors in like old shows, and you're like, oh shit! Like my wife and I watch Gilmore Girls, and Rami Malek just shows up when he was like 14 as like some Jewish kid or whatever.
Dude, no, that's funny you say that. I was watching for some reason The Dark Knight Rises last night, and Glenn Powell is in that movie.
Oh, that's right. He's one of the Wall Street douchebags.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, hey, there's no money here. Or right, whatever. He's, like, he's that guy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he's like, this is the stock exchange. There's no money you can steal here. And there's like,
then what Bane's are like, you people doing here?
Yeah. Dude, Bane yeah. is great in that movie. I love all his line deliveries are so funny.
Mr.
He's like,
Megaphone.
I am the League of Shadows. Yeah.
Like, it's really funny. I think it's funny because like Tom Hardy's like 5'6" playing
it's
Bane.
It's so funny. And Bane's supposed to be like a Mexican luchador.
Yeah, he's
usually
fucking huge.
I mean,
I don't know.
It's kind of weird because I feel like Bane in the comics is like basically just like a moron, right? He can't even speak.
No,
right?
No,
not at
he's
all.
He's literally so smart. He's like a super hyper intelligent guy. And depending on the story, he gets venom and it kind of like affects his memory. Like he takes that to be stronger, but it'll affect his memory. That's how they explain in the Arkham games, at least. But he's like, a lot of the times he figures out who Batman is.
Oh,
if
wait.
You ever want another
all the adaptations I've seen, like the animated shows, like Bane is depicted as an idiot. So I thought
that's just kind of what they did in like the Batman Forever shit, just because
he's a big monster guy. Yeah.
But if you ever want a good comic series to read, since you're actually reading comics now, just get the Batman Nightfall omnibuses, and that's the full Bane saga with Batman, and it's so good.
Where he gets his back broken. Spoilers. Yeah.
Is that where they got that from?
Batman and everything
from The Dark Knight Rises. Yeah.
That's where it's from. You think
The Nightfall?
Yeah, it is. It's so good, and you can get those comics for like $10. Like both. There's only two of them, I think.
Dude, I was watching The Dark Knight Rises, and I was thinking like they've really made an effort to make this more like MCU quippy. I didn't realize that because I haven't seen this movie in years. But then there's probably a joke like every 2 to 5 minutes in that movie, whereas in The Dark Knight it's like serious as fuck, you know? Did you guys notice that
yeah.
where it's like Catwoman vanishes and he's like, so that's what that feels like.
Yeah, yeah, like some stuff like that. Yeah, where
I think the second one also was way further that direction than,
well, I mean, it's because you got the Joker. That guy's a real funny guy.
Yeah. All right, well, you guys, yeah, let's wrap it up here.
Before we wrap up, I have a thing I found out today that I kind of have to share. If your name was Walton Goggins, what business would you start up?
Goggles?
What
or something?
I'm going to send you guys a group chat message. I need you to look at this real quick. because Cecil Stedman, voice actor, Walton Goggins has a company called Walton's Goggins Goggle Glasses, where he sells goggles. I think they're like snowboarding goggles.
They look crazy.
That's good.
They look weird. Only he can pull that off. That's so funny. I found that out. I thought it was a joke, but it's not.
Walton Goggins goggle glasses. Like
pit vipers for skiing.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's pretty sick. I just
thought that was pretty funny.
That's awesome.
Say that five times fast.
Walton Goggins glasses. Walton Goggins goggle glasses. I suck at tongue twisters. It's pretty tricky.
But what's your rec, Ethan?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we have a new movie coming out this year that we're all going to see called 28 Years Later. So I figured we should use this as an excuse before we get too close to that release date. We should talk about the previous days and weeks before that in the form of 28 Days Later from 2002 by Danny Boyle and 28 Weeks Later from 2007 by Juan Carlos Fresnadillo. So that's those are my recs. I have never seen these movies.
Sounds good. Also, we either need to watch Death of a Unicorn or Working Man this weekend. What are we doing?
Wait, I thought we were doing the zombie movies.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, but you think that's going to take up all our time?
I think that'll take. I think
we already got two movies.
Yeah, but we're not gonna see unicorn movie.
I don't know what the hell that is.
Yeah, what are these? I don't even know.
It's the one with Paul. It's the one with Paul Rudd.
On us mid-recording,
it's the one with Paul Rudd and Jen. What's the chick that's in everything?
Jenna Ortega,
and it has the guy who's handsome that kissed.
We'll think
Jennifer
about
Aniston.
When you're trying to make us think of actors, you got to give us more to go on. You're like
that one guy. That
who's the guy?
Will Poulter.
Who's the guy from New York that's an asshole? And then who's the handsome actor?
Okay, that guy. You should know that guy.
We know Will Poulter. I know Will Poulter. Yeah.
No, I meant the asshole New York guy. The guy who talks like this. And he's like not a good actor.
What do you mean?
I'll find it after the podcast. It's fine.
Joe Pantoliano from like The Sopranos and The Matrix?
No, he's a worse actor.
He's a good actor. But anyway, go on, Ethan.
If you guys enjoyed this episode of our podcast, please go ahead and leave us a like if you're watching on YouTube, or if you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please leave us a 5-star review because that really means a lot. And if you don't want to be spoiled for 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later, make sure to watch them before next episode. Thank you everybody for watching. And of course, as always,
get stuckmanized.
Get stuckmanized.
Mwah.